Sounds True presents Tape 4 of After the Ecstasy, The Laundry with Jack Kornfield.
This Very Body, the Buddha. Within this fathom-long body is found all of the teachings, is found suffering, the cause of suffering, and the end of suffering, said the Buddha. It is also helpful to realize that this very body that we have, that's sitting right here, right now, with its aches and its pleasures, is exactly what we need to be fully human, fully awake, fully alive. This from Pema Chodron. Before enlightenment, we have to live with our body. After enlightenment, we still have to live with our body. Zen master Dainen Katagiri says, "The important thing of spiritual practice is not to try to escape your life, but to face it exactly and completely." He speaks both to those who are beginning on the path and to those who have realized some measure of awakening. No matter where we are on the journey of awakening, the body must be included. Yet it is also true that both Eastern and Western religious traditions have dishonored this truth. There are aspects of every tradition that stress denial and aversion to the physical self, that fear the body and have disdain for its impulses. In one Burmese monastery where I practiced, certain masters forbade yoga, stretching, and exercise, telling students to throw themselves into months of intensive meditation and abandon all concern for the body. Many students accepted this admonition. How could they distrust their teacher's words? Years later, they found themselves struggling to reclaim their bodies and health in order finally to live wisely. A traditional story attempts to awaken students to our loss of connection. In ancient China, there lived a widower with two loving daughters. When his eldest daughter died, he was left with only the youngest, Senjo. Because she was beautiful, many sought her hand, and when she came of age, Senjo's father selected a good and prosperous husband for her from among her suitors. But alas, Senjo had long before fallen in love with Ochu. They had known each other since playing in childhood, when Senjo's father had laughingly told them they were well matched and should get married when they grew up. Somehow they took him to heart, and imagining they were engaged, they came to love each other deeply. When Senjo heard that she was promised to another, she was so distressed she almost fainted. So greatly grieved was Ochu that he felt he could only withstand the pain of his broken heart by secretly running away. That evening at midnight, he untied his small boat from the village dock and began to paddle downstream. He saw a figure rush out of the bushes, then run alongside the river. It was Senjo. They embraced and wept, and Senjo climbed into the boat and joined him as they drifted to a remote village downstream. They married and lived there for 5 years, starting a farm and raising two children. But in her heart, Senjo was worried for her father and felt ungrateful to have fled. Her unresolved past haunted her, tinging her happiness with grief. When she told Ochu, he admitted he too was longing for his home. They immediately decided to return and beg her family's forgiveness. Hiring a larger boat, they took the children upstream and docked in the village at dusk. When Ochu went to Senjo's father's house to beg for pardon, he was received with bitter astonishment. Her father would not believe his daughter was in the boat. "From the day you left, my daughter has lain here in bed, too sick to speak." Ochu was taken aback. "She's in the boat, father, with two fine grandchildren," he pleaded. "Come to the dock, see for yourself." But the father sent his servant to look. And when the excited servant returned to say, "Yes, it is true," the bewildered man went back to the sickbed of his silent daughter and told her the story. Immediately the ill Senjo became filled with energy and rose from the bed without a word. She walked out of the house and down the road followed by her father. As soon as she met the other Senjo and her children, the two embraced and instantly became one. Later, the reunited Senjo said that all along in both lives, she had the feeling she was living in a dream. What can we learn from this story, with its sorrowful tale of a divided life? Senjo had to cut off a great part of herself in order to live at all, and each half suffered in its own way. But there's also hope, for Senjo's determination to return invites our return as well. Like Senjo, many of us discover we live partially in a dream world, cut off from whole pieces of our life, our body, our past. It was not always this way. When we are born, there's an original wholeness, a oneness with our mother and our own body. Then, over the years of growing to be an individual in society, we lose this wholeness. As we repeatedly encounter the lack of respect and nurturance that's typical of many modern families, the judgments and fears of those close to us, the inevitable frustrations, loss, and cultural fragmentation that trying to meet society's expectation brings, we begin to separate from our own sacred body and our deepest feelings. This often takes place invisibly and unconsciously in the dark, just like Senjo's running to follow Ochu's boat at midnight. Though we can sense our disconnection, we do not know exactly what is wrong. James Joyce captured this dilemma when he wrote of one character. Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body. Joan Tollefson, a Zen teacher, writes about how difficult it can be to simply acknowledge the truth of our body. She was born with the lower part of one arm missing. She describes a childhood in which children gasped in horror. Some people told me how amazingly well I tie my shoes, and even more deadly, some people pretended not to notice, and nobody would say a word. If she was in an elevator with children, and they asked her what happened to her, their parents would instantly silence them. Shh, don't talk about it. Then, Joan discovered meditation, and for years she would sit with one hand making half of a circular mudra, trying to be a proper Zen student. But in some ways, she still had not actually looked at herself. I remember the first time I really looked at my arm, I was 25 years old. It took that long to develop the courage to see what actually was. And yet when you do so, she writes, the horror is not in your body, but in your head. Although it may be painful to look closely at our arms and legs, our belly and breasts, our face and our skin, our genitals and our hair, the cost of not looking is greater. Not looking brings a loss of feeling and connection with ourselves in this earth, with our very human life. It engenders a loss of our innate and instinctive wisdom. Even after years of spiritual practice, we can still be like Senjo before her return, our contentment and happiness weighed down by abandoned and unfaced parts of ourselves. A loss of connection to embodied life is not just our individual predicament. This loss is embedded in the speed and pervasive disconnection of modern consumer society. The poet Adrian Rich voices the sorrow hidden beneath our busy lives. The problem, unstated until now, is how to live in a damaged body, in a world where pain is meant to be gagged, uncured, ungrieved over. The problem is to connect, without hysteria, the pain of anyone's body with the pain of the world's body. One Western Tibetan Lama speaks about how he encountered this. I've seen a lot of pathological detachment in myself and others. Long years of retreat put me in touch with a lot of things, but I also went along with the old Buddhist culture where things get ignored and pushed away. I don't know how many meditation teachers, lamas, vipassana teachers I've met who are having trouble with their health. You could say sickness is natural, is part of the Buddha's first noble truth of suffering. But most of these teachers hadn't taken care of their bodies for years. And me? I used to pride myself on how calm and detached I was, never upset or letting myself feel anger, beyond all stress, flatlining my brain. But what about my body? Which organs have I been stuffing it all into, to the detriment of my health? Now, 25 years later, I'm starting to respect my body, my need for rest, for exercise, to find the physical wisdom I lost for so long. If we are to become whole, we must reclaim the body, holding even its pain and limitation as our own. This was true for a senior Buddhist practitioner whose parents were Holocaust survivors and who said, "I was born into trauma, and I've discovered that I've been holding my breath for the whole of my life." It was true for the yoga teacher who pushed her body to be perfect until, "I realized I was terrified of aging, of losing my looks, of my own weakness and vulnerability. My yoga was a way of trying to control my life." One rabbi had traveled far on her journey before she realized the need for integration of her body. Women have such fear around the body. I guess men do too. In my spiritual life, I've worked with deep wounds in this area. In its wisest teachings, Judaism holds sexuality in the body as sacred and recognizes that to abuse it is to abuse what is divine. Now, after many years of being a rabbi and of healing, I've started learning yoga and movement and Jewish dances. I realize that the energy of the body is the energy of God. We have to value it. Everything comes through it. Embodied enlightenment. Enlightenment must be here and now, through this very body, or else it is not genuine. In this body and mind, we find the cause of suffering and the end of suffering. For awakening to be an opening into freedom in this very life, the body must be its ground. Embodied enlightenment is not about special psychophysical accomplishments, mastering the yogas of inner fire, fulfilling sexual tantras, or developing a rainbow body. Yes, certain Tibetan lamas can sit naked in the snow at 18,000 feet and generate sufficient heat to melt the snow in a 20-foot circle around their bodies. And Catholic saints have demonstrated stigmata and miraculous healing powers. But these powers are not the true miracle, said the Buddha. Awakening to the truth is the miracle. Embodied enlightenment is about living wisely in your particular body as it is on this day in this amazing life. Western Buddhist meditation master and nun Pema Chodron calls this understanding the wisdom of no escape. It is helpful to realize, she says, that being here, sitting in meditation, doing simple everyday things like working, walking outside, talking with people, eating, using the toilet, is actually all that we need to be fully awake, fully alive, fully human. It's also helpful to realize that this body that we have, this very body that's sitting here right now in this room, this very body that perhaps aches, and this mind that we have at this very moment, are exactly what we need to be fully human, fully awake, fully alive. Furthermore, the emotions that we have right now, the negativity and positivity, are what we actually need. It is just as if we looked around to find out what would be the greatest wealth we could possibly possess in order to lead a decent, good, completely fulfilling, energetic, inspired life, and found it all right here. Enlightenment flowers, not as an ideal, but in the miraculous reality of our human form, with its pleasures and pains. No master can escape this truth, nor does enlightenment make the vulnerability of our body go away. The Buddha had illnesses and backaches. Sages like Ramana Maharshi, Karmapa, and Suzuki Roshi died of cancer in spite of their holy understanding. Their example shows we must find awakening in sickness and in health, in pleasure and in pain, in this human body as it is. How do we touch this body of life, the joys and sorrows of it? An embodied awakening neither denies nor reviles the body, nor does it grasp and mindlessly indulge in pleasures. In embodied awakening, we become present for the life that is given us, respectful of what the Tibetans call this precious human form. Tsongkhapa, the Tibetan master, taught, "This human body is more precious than the rarest gem. Cherish your body. It is yours for this one time only, a thing of beauty that passes away." Such a respectful presence allows the life of our body to be blessed. One elder, a Catholic father and teacher, speaks of the gratitude and blessedness he's learned in the body. "I came from a poor white family where we drank and lived hard. The men treated the body like a truck that you used and ignored. In the church, it got worse. I hated to deal with my body. I lived on coffee and then on scotch. Gradually, as I looked at the simple people who came to talk to me and saw how many tortured bodies there were, as well as tortured souls, my faith and love got past all the junk about sin and the body in church. It doesn't have to be so hard. I realized that Christ taught I had to love my enemy. I took a vow of nonviolence, and this included my body. My practice became, do not torment myself. Do not escalate the pain. I began to teach it to others. It turned into a practice of gratitude. I get up in the morning, and the care of my body is where I start. It's poignant how simple it is." No part left out. As we have seen, one of the most important challenges to living in embodied enlightenment is in the area of sexuality. Religious traditions often warn us about the dangers of entanglement with the senses, and it is true that we can become overly attached and identified with this body and its pleasures. Our culture has exploited this to an extreme. But in spiritual circles, the opposite danger of aversion, fear, and unconsciousness is perhaps even more common. There is, as the Buddha suggests, a middle path to be found in each of our lives. One yoga teacher paused in the midst of teaching a difficult stretch to caution her students. "You strivers here, relax. And you sensualists, you straighten up." Carl Jung writes of the necessary balance between our animal body and its connection through eros to the highest forms of spirit. The erotic instinct is something questionable and will always be so, whatever laws may have to say on the matter. It belongs, on the one hand, to the original animal nature of man, which will exist as long as man has an animal body. On the other hand, it is connected with the highest forms of the spirit, but it blooms only when spirit and instinct are in true harmony. If one or the other aspect is missing, then an injury occurs. There's a one-sided lack of balance, which easily slips into the pathological. Too much of the animal disfigures the civilized human being. Too much culture makes for a sick animal. The most rigid forms of spirituality simply condemn sexuality. More wisely, it is the misuse of sexuality that is described as a cause of suffering. The Ten Commandments teach us to refrain from adultery. The Buddhist precepts call on us not to bring suffering by inappropriate sexuality. But the fear of causing harm can easily turn into a fear of the body and of sexuality in general. By contrast, one Sufi master told me that in his tradition, it was taught that masters become sexier as they become more awakened. He did not mean simply sexual, but more full-bodied, awake, alive. Jack Engler, a Buddhist teacher and Harvard psychologist, once spoke about his training as a novice under the renowned Trappist monk Thomas Merton. Thomas Merton, he reported, was the sexiest man I ever met. In the early 1980s, in an attempt to understand and honor sexuality as a conscious part of the spiritual path, I interviewed 53 Zen masters, lamas, swamis, and or their senior students about their sexuality. Here is part of the article I then wrote for the Yoga Journal. Like any group of people in our culture, their practices varied. There were heterosexuals, bisexuals, homosexuals, exhibitionists, monogamists, and polygamists. There were teachers who were celibate and happy, and those who were celibate and miserable. There were those who were married and monogamous, and those who had many clandestine affairs. There were teachers who were promiscuous and open about it. There were those who made conscious and committed sexual relationships an aspect of their spirituality. And there were many more teachers who were no more enlightened or conscious about their sexuality than everyone else around them. While we know that wise sexuality can bring intimacy, connection, and surrender, wise and holy celibacy can do the same. Both choices can be an expression of love and awareness. An embodied enlightenment brings consciousness and respect to our body without our becoming lost in the extremes of indulgence or self-denial. In Hindu and Buddhist Tantra, sexuality is valued as a route to awakening. In Jewish and Sufi traditions, it is celebrated as divine. Embodied sensuality and eros are honored and transformed. In the same spirit, celibacy can be honored and transformed in the holiness of the heart. The vital life of the body can be known through both paths. This precious human body is a holy treasure house for action and awakening. Holy the heart, holy the ears, holy the limbs and breasts, holy the feet and hands, holy the breath and skin, holy the hair and genitals, the liver, the lungs, the blood, the tiniest cells, and the breath of life. The poet Eduardo Galeano put it this way. The church says the body is a sin. Science says the body is a machine. Advertising says the body is a business. The body says, I am a fiesta. When the precious human body is properly tended, its benevolence spills over to all of life. The impulses to tend, to care for, to heal, to embody love and freedom grow in us. The worlds that have been separated in us come together to make a whole. At one of his last teachings before retiring at age 80, Robert Aiken Roshi talked to a gathering of 100 Buddhist teachers about his half century of Zen practice, starting in prison in Japan during World War II. At the end, he was asked if he would offer a koan and be willing to give us the answer. He told us this tale. In 1951, when he was practicing in New York under Master Nyogen Senzaki, Master Senzaki held up an elegant bowl painted with a spiral from the rim to the center. He asked, "Does this spiral go from the outside in or from the inside out?" This was the koan, and we quietly contemplated its solution. Then came the moment to offer an answer. Aiken Roshi stood up from his cushion, trembling slightly, and extended his arms outward like a great, frail bird, making the shape of a bowl with his whole, outstretched body. First, he turned one way, as if spiraling in. Then, he turned the other way, as if spiraling out. He became the bowl with his whole body, with his whole being, inside and out. This was his answer. The Wisdom of Incarnation. In May of 1998, at Spirit Rock Meditation Center, we hosted a large benefit for the medical care of Ram Dass, who'd suffered a major stroke the year before. Almost a year after rehabilitation, Ram Dass was able to talk, though haltingly, and he still groped for words. At the end of the day, his wheelchair was placed on the stage so he could speak, noting, to much laughter, that he had been warned it was tacky to come to one's own benefit, and that's why he came. Ram Dass addressed his predicament and the question of identity. For years, I practiced as a karma yogi the path of service. I wrote books about learning to serve, how to help others. Now it's reversed. I need people to help me get up and put me to bed. Others feed me and wash my bottom. And I can tell you, it's harder to be the one who is helped than the helper. But this is just another stage. It feels like I died and have been reborn over and over. In the 60s, I was a professor at Harvard, and when that ended, I went out with Tim Leary spreading psychedelics. Then in the 70s, I died from that and returned from India as Baba Ram Dass the Guru. Then in the 80s, my life was all about service, co-founding the Seva Foundation, building hospitals, working with refugees and prisoners. Over all these years, I played cello, golf, drove my MG. Since this stroke, the car is in the driveway, the cello and the golf clubs in the closet. Now, if I think I'm the guy who can't play cello or drive or work in India, I would feel terribly sorry for myself. But I'm not him. During the stroke, I died again, and now I have a new life in a disabled body. This is where I am. You've got to be here now. You've got to take the curriculum. This is the Wisdom of Incarnation. In it, we willingly step into life, neither frightened by it nor lost in it, but awake and free in whatever the moment presents. Kabir, the Indian mystic poet, writes, "Jump into experience while you are alive. What you call salvation belongs to the time before death." To enter life requires a radical understanding that holiness, God, nirvana are not found apart from experience, but are its essence. What we seek is what we are. The Heart Sutra teaches this truth in the phrase, "Form is no different than emptiness," while Simeon, the Christian mystic, speaks of awakening in Christ's body as Christ awakens in ours. The key to this open and free heart came to the Buddha after years of fighting against his body. He wandered through India for 6 years, fasting and undertaking extreme and arduous ascetic practices in a battle to overpower all bodily desires and fears. Finally, he found himself exhausted, close to death, lying on the earth. Spontaneously, a memory arose from when he was a boy seated under a rose apple tree in his father's garden. He remembered how there had come to him on that spring morning, all unbidden, a wondrous sense of wholeness and stillness, his heart at rest and at home in the midst of all things. Amazed, he realized that his whole spiritual quest for liberation had been misguided, a fruitless fight against his body and the world. With this vision, he discovered the middle path, an inner unity that neither struggles against the world nor becomes lost and entangled in it. He opened his heart to the suffering and beauty in life as it is and rested in peace. And at that moment, a young woman came by and, seeing the emaciated sage, gave him a bowl of the milk rice she was carrying. The Buddha drank gratefully, and now refreshed in body as in spirit. Then he returned to his meditation with a renewed understanding of his path. Embodied courage. The fruits of embodiment, of fullness, wisdom, and compassion, do not come without a price. When my teacher Ajahn Chah was 63, he entered a hospital for a combination of water on the brain, diabetes, stroke, and heart problems. He was hospitalized for 9 months in grave pain and often unable to speak. When he was released the following year, some of his capacities returned, and he was able to resume teaching in a limited fashion. I went to visit him at a temple near Bangkok and saw how much weaker and older he looked after this ordeal. I bowed respectfully. At some point in our conversation, I was reminded of how often over the years he had exhorted us to reflect on the inevitability of old age, sickness, and death, and noted out loud how they were now visibly happening to him. Ajahn Chah fixed me with a piercing gaze and said, "Don't say that so lightly." Spiritual dedication gives us no immunity from the joys and sorrows of life's body. Every spiritual master faces the difficulties of fatigue, sickness, and death just as we do. What dedicated practice gives us are the tools to awaken compassion and awareness in this human realm, ways for the heart to hold it all. Every part of life is a fertile field for practice. Rachel Naomi Remen, a physician and healer, speaks of sickness as a gateway, an invitation to deepen our soul's connection with life. She says the goal of illness is to bring us back to what is important to us, to wake us up. The point of spiritual practice is not to wait for illness or death to awaken us, but to draw on the life and health we have now to bring peace to our body, heart, and mind. And if we do not have the courage to enter our body fully, then life itself may simply insist. As Marcel Proust reminds us, illness is the most heeded of doctors. To goodness and wisdom, we only make promises. Pain, we obey. When we listen to our bodies, our bodily wisdom grows. We can feel the body's urge to move and honor its cycles of rest. We can meditate and dance. We can respect its need for solitude. We can allow its lively senses, and we can know its pleasures and limitations. Instead of fearing our body, its losses and strange vulnerability, we honor it. When the mandala of awakening includes rather than excludes the body, our gifts can flower and our heart remains free. Rabbi Nachman of Bratislava tried to get his disciples to understand that. If you never want to see the face of hell, when you come home from work every night, dance with your kitchen towel, and if you're worried about waking up your family, take off your shoes. Embodied courage chooses not to wait until the specter of sickness and death demands attention. Instead, let us willingly enter this bodily existence. Let us sacrifice the false ideals for the reality of the present. It is all we have. One Zen story concerns a fervent disciple asking his master for the truth of enlightenment. The master, pointing to two nearby groves of bamboo, asks, "See that bamboo on the left, how tall it is? And see that bamboo on the right, how short it is? That is their nature." The disciple was enlightened. Accepting the truth is the gate to awakening. At this moment, what is our nature? Can we accept this too? Embodiment and the Laundry. Hakuin Zenji wrote in his ancient Song of Zazen, "All beings by nature are Buddha, as ice by nature is water. How sad that people ignore the near and search for truth afar, like someone in the midst of water crying out for thirst. Truly, is anything missing now? Nirvana is right here, before our eyes. This very place is the pure lotus land, this very body, the Buddha. For Hakuin, the gateway to living in Nirvana is embodied awareness. Holiness of being comes by entering the moment fully with our wholehearted attention. All the outer forms of religion, the temples, the teachers, the practices, simply call us to the eternal present, invite us to bend down the heart to touch each moment. A Chinese fable tells of a young man observing a sage at the village well. The old man was lowering a wooden bucket on a rope and pulling the water up slowly, hand over hand. The youth disappeared and returned with a pulley. He approached the old man and showed him how the device worked. "See? You put your rope around the wheel and draw up the water by cranking the handle." The old man resisted. "If I use a device like this, my mind will think itself clever. With a cunning mind, I will no longer put my heart into what I am doing. Soon my wrists alone will do the work. If my heart and whole body are not in my work will become joyless. And when my work is joyless, how do you think the water will taste?" The water reflects our spirit. In Zen it is said that the whole moon and sky are reflected in a drop of dew in the grass. Each small thing, each moment, is a contribution to and a reflection of the whole. Tucking a child in bed, paying the bills, listening to a business associate, paying the attendant at the gas station, writing a letter or typing a memo, meeting over a meal, planning a job, watering the garden, each becomes the embodiment of the awakened heart. It is amazing that we can forget this truth. A young girl, age 6, asked her mama to tell her what she did at the university where she went every day. "I'm in the art department. I teach people how to draw and paint," replied her mother. Astonished, the girl inquired, "You mean they forget?" When we forget, awakening calls us back to bless the simple activities of each moment. One Western Lama recalls using prayerful, physical work to stay awake and grounded after returning from a 3-year Tibetan retreat. "It was the hardest thing to keep my spiritual life alive in the stream of so many daily activities and the enormous, unnecessary complexity of Western life. The first 5 years were the most difficult, keeping my heart simple inside while being with people who have no sensibility other than getting and hurrying. Initially, it felt unstable, almost crazy. I was afraid I would forget what I learned. So I relied on the physical work to stabilize my practice and mind. I did a huge amount of cleaning. I specialized in washing, mopping, laundry. Nobody around me wanted to clean anyway. Everybody was happy to have someone else doing it. I used to quietly sing a mantra of compassion with each dish that I washed, each floor I cleaned. And I included the prayer that as I clean, may the eyes and hearts of all beings around me be clean and purified, made innocent and clear. Time would stop as if I was part of the earth cleansing itself in spring. It was a beautiful way to work. The simplest physical tasks are the entry to learn to be with this world in a sacred manner. Hindus and Sufis teach that each act can be done for the beloved. Embodying mindfulness, we fold the laundry as if folding the robes of Jesus or Buddha. We serve a meal not for ourselves or our family, but for the Holy One. When the body is included in the mandala of practice, every small act is held in the heart as well as the hands. There are so many simple practices to return us to our body, to our heart, to this moment. A prayer before entering each door, a reflection before we eat, a pause to breathe mindfully before answering the phone. A prayer or verse can be created even for watching television, says Zen Master Thich Nhat Hanh. Watching the evening news, I know it is my story. Breathing in calmly, I hold us all in compassion. Remembering the breath, we return all things to their seat in the body. When one Zen student told his master, "All that's left to finish up are some of the details," the master exclaimed, "But details are all there are." Embodied presence reminds us to be with each thing in turn. Gandhi called this blessed monotony and likened the round of each day to the sun and moon in their regular orbs, the silent cycle of the stars and the seasons. Zen teaches it is like baking bread in the oven. You do it over and over, and you eat each loaf's particular flavor. Claude Monet lived in Giverny for 35 years, painting the same water lilies year after year in each new day's light. To look with the freshness of eyes that see today's light anew, this is the beginner's mind. This simple intimacy of actual physical service was at the center of Mother Teresa's work as well. "I never look at the masses as my responsibility," she said. "I look at the individual. I can only love one person at a time, just one, one, one. So you begin. I began. I picked up one person. Maybe if I didn't pick up that one person, I wouldn't have picked up 42,000. The whole work is only a drop in the ocean, but if I didn't put the drop in, the ocean would be one drop less. The same thing goes for you, the same thing in your family, the same thing in your church, your community. Just begin. One, one, one." Mystics, teachers, and adepts tell us that we must awaken to the sacred in the ordinary. As Thomas Merton puts it, life is this simple. We are living in a world that is absolutely transparent, and the divine is shining through it all the time. This is not just a nice story or a fable. It is true. Freedom of the heart is not found by looking up. It is right here, woven in colors, beneath our feet. Awakened Emotions and Ordinary Perfection. In the Satipatthana Sutra, the Buddha says, "Monks, you must be aware of pleasant feelings, neutral feelings, and unpleasant feelings. You must establish mindfulness of the feelings in the feelings." When a student asked, "You teach us to just sit when we sit, just eat when we eat. Could a Zen master be just angry in the same way?" Suzuki Roshi replied, "You mean to just get angry like a thunderstorm and be done when it passes? Ah, I wish I could do that." And Tweedledum from Alice in Wonderland, who says, "I'm very brave generally, only today I happen to have a headache." How are we to understand emotional life after awakening has begun? Some traditions portray the awakened heart as totally unmovable. In the Anguttara Nikaya, the Buddha tells us, "Just as a solid rock remains unmoved by the wind, even so, neither sense impressions nor contacts of any kind, pleasant or unpleasant, desired or undesired, can cause the heart of one who has truly awakened to waver." I was taught this in many ways. Once, as I was weeping in meditation, Our visiting meditation master, Deepa Mabarua, said that such grieving was unnecessary for a yogi. Meditation teachers don't cry, she told me. Yet my first meditation master, Ajahn Chah, had said exactly the opposite. Tears are part of meditation. If you have not wept deeply, you have not begun to meditate. In some situations, the Buddha decries grief as unnecessary clinging. Yet at other times, the Buddhist texts tell us that he will evoke grief in his listeners to awaken the tears and softness of their hearts so that fully open and attentive, they can know the depths of the teachings. Different lineages regard the emotions in different ways. In some traditions, the unconscious patterns of greed, hatred, delusion, and fear are said to disappear completely. Others teach that they remain but are transformed into experiences of wisdom and compassion. But every wise tradition offers the possibility of a deep freedom of spirit. This unquenchable spirit must be discovered amidst the power of life's emotions and storms, its love unshakable. Vulnerability and the tender heart. Several years ago, some friends arranged for the Gyuto Tantric Choir, the Tibetan monks famous for their deep, multivocal chanting, to perform in San Quentin Prison. Then the San Quentin Gospel Choir would sing in response. But as the day approached, it became clear to the organizers that there would be a cultural gap to overcome. The members of the San Quentin Gospel Choir were all African Americans, many of them big men who worked out with weights. In their years in prison, they had been born again, touched by the Spirit of Jesus, and their songs were testimonials to their depths of suffering and to the light of the gospel that had been awakened in them. The organizers feared that the Tibetan monks would appear to be merely foreigners and heathens to these newly awakened Christians. When the heathen monks arrived, the contrast was even more apparent. Dwarfed by the African Americans was a group of small Asian men wearing maroon skirts. The question was how to bridge this gap.